Hello, and welcome to the History of the Cards, episode 82, A Kingdom is Born. So last time, we stopped at the fall of Jerusalem to the Crusaders in 1099, just before the start of the 12th century. The surprise victory came while Afdal was preparing a large 20,000-man army to defend his territory, which was ready exactly 3 weeks after the city fell. So talk about a close call. Nonetheless, even after Jerusalem fell, was the army there? Al-Afdal decided to use it anyway, and he moved it to Ashkelon, a strategic city that lay in between Jerusalem and Sinai, with plans to use it as a base to attack Jerusalem. The Crusaders, fresh off their victory, rather than waiting Jerusalem to be besieged and die a slow death of starvation, they decided to go ahead and take the fight to Al-Afdal, which was a little crazy, because one, they again fought internally who would rule Jerusalem, and there was lots of bad blood in between them, and two, they were easily outnumbered 2-1, which is exactly why they succeeded. Al-Afdal was literally caught asleep when they attacked at dawn in early August 1099. Waking up to a surprise attack, he panicked, abandoned his troops, and jumped on a ship, sailing back to Egypt. With the general gone, the army went into a state of panic and started running, which is the worst thing you can do, facing lance-wielding, charging knights. Heavy losses were suffered, but a few survivors managed to get to the city and lock the gates, surviving the quickness of battle, for the likely prolonged this of a siege, with slim hopes of relief from Cairo, given that Al-Afdal just ran away. And so, almost immediately, they sought terms to surrender the city in return for their safety. Alas, despite the garrison literally doing everything in their power to give Ashkelon away, the Crusaders did not take it, leaving it under the control of Al-Afdal. The reason this has happened, we are told, is that the richest warlord of the bunch, a certain Rehman of Tulu, was left with nothing to rule after a series of missteps. Basically, there was a lot of bad optics around him from being a little too greedy and egotistical for the optics of the holy journey. But anyway, Ashkelon was his last chance of getting something material from his adventure, and so he was an eager negotiator with the garrison. His rival, the guy who led the group that conquered Jerusalem and eventually its ruler, a certain Godfrey, had absolutely no desire to have Rehman as his neighbor, and so he went out of his way to ensure that the city did not surrender. Basically, for him, better the Fatimids than Rehman. And so, for the careful listener, we have now introduced 3 out of our 4 leaders of the Crusades. Bohemond, the guy who raided Byzantium before crusading and now in charge of Antioch. Rehman, the rich guy who ended up going back empty-handed. And Godfrey, the conqueror of Jerusalem and its first ruler. What about the 4th, you ask? Well, he is quite an interesting guy, and we will get to him in a second, as he will require far more than a blip in our narrative. Anyway, now that you know about Godfrey, it's time to say goodbye to him. Conquering Jerusalem and squandering Ashkelon was more or less all his legacy, as he died shortly after, while negotiating a tribute from the governor of Caesarea, where he may or may not have been poisoned. For now, The one thing that I wanted to emphasize is that leaving Ashkelon to the Fatimids was a big mistake, as it allowed them to put a lot of pressure on Jerusalem. I put up a map on Patreon, but basically Jerusalem is an inland city, far away from Europe. To keep it, you must keep the ports around it. That's how you can get fighters and pilgrims, both of which are needed to keep the city alive. So if you have no ports, you have no Jerusalem. Ashkelon was one of these ports to keep, and for the Egyptian army, it was the only one that mattered, since it was the closest. Without Ashkelon, an Egyptian army would have to trek a long hostile route through the western desert and then Sinai, making the idea of campaigning against Jerusalem expensive and a little impractical. But with Ashkelon, a few ships can transport that army quickly through the Mediterranean with ease, like every single year. So keep that in mind, as there would be a long-running game over that city, especially when we get to future crusades. But again, for now, that victory, but not really victory, at Ashkelon is considered the end of the First Crusade by traditional accounts. Not because the wars ended. No, the fighting would never really stop for the next 250 years or so. But because almost all of the crusaders went back after this point, leaving only a skeleton crew of about 2,000 men to defend their newly acquired territory. Remember, this whole thing was an armed pilgrimage, and so the expectation was to go back. Most of these guys had family and things to take care of in Europe. Unlike the Seljuks or past/future new arrivals in the Middle East, this was not supposed to be a mass migration conquest or a colonization project. It turned out to be the latter for sure, but that was not the original intention. At this point, the whole thing was about, quote-unquote, liberating Jerusalem and being able to keep the holy city in Christian hands. As an exercise to appreciate the scale of the whole thing, if you were to go back and pick 100 random crusaders and follow them, the vast majority, about 80, would have died or deserted before even reaching Jerusalem. 15 would have made it and went back home after making their pilgrimage, absolutely broke and exhausted, but with a celebrated reputation and a fancy title, so-and-so of Jerusalem. And only 5 from the original 100 would have stayed in the newly acquired land to protect it, which really made the whole operation extremely rickety and unstable. And so, the fighting never stopped. By 1101, as the old crusaders were returning and word was reaching Europe of their exploits, all of a sudden, a bunch of folks jumped on the bandwagon, encouraged by a new pope to undertake a new crusade. Unfortunately for these guys, they were even more disunited than the first group, and by now, the Seljuk Turks appreciated the existential threat that the continued crusades presented, and so they all fell in line behind the Sultan of Rum, rather than continue their infighting. To make a long story short, the new crusaders never made it out of Anatolia. They were picked off one group after another by the Turks. It was really an epic failure that is remembered in the primary sources as the Crusade of the Faint-Hearted. For us, though, it resulted in a couple of things. First, the Sultanate of Rome was consolidated and essentially recovered from the humiliating losses of the First Crusade. Sure, they lost some of the coastal cities in Anatolia, but that was it. There would be no more losses for a while. Second, in Egypt, Al-Afdal realized that the Crusaders can be defeated, and so, rather than seek peace with the new arrivals, year after year, he raided and attacked Jerusalem, and other than one early close call, his efforts were a total failure. He was like a gambler. Every time he lost, he doubled down, hoping for just one victory that will make him break even. And he never got it. We will go into the weeds of his campaigns in a second. But in the big picture, his failures and the rapidly increased expenses of his campaigns would take a toll, especially as his hand-picked caliph would die suddenly as the crusade of the faint-hearted was fizzling out. And Al-Afdal had to manage another tricky transition and appoint a 5-year-old child as the new caliph. When that new caliph, Al-Amir, grows up, unlike his father and grandfather before him, he would not be interested in playing the role of a puppet. Unfortunately, he would be in the middle of a decade-long war and would be totally unprepared to handle the large army and the constant warfare that was left to him by Al-Afdal. But that's in the big picture. He's only 5 for now, so we have a while to get there. On the ground, in Jerusalem, like I said, the whole thing stood on such a rickety foundation that every day it survived, it was like a miracle. So, when the kingdom's first ruler, Godfrey, died, barely lasting a year, it was like an earthquake that shook those foundations. Godfrey was never really appointed king. No, merely the protector of the city. So, who was going to follow him was a big open question. Enter our fourth leader of the Crusades, Baldwin. The guy who split from the Crusaders early on to capture Edessa. Now, Baldwin was by far the best man for the job. An ambitious younger son shot out of Europe, who knew his way around an army camp. He was exceedingly hungry for power, conniving, and was a quick horse and even quicker temper. As his personal priest put it, Baldwin, quote, grieved somewhat at the death of his brother, but rejoiced more over his inheritance. Like I said, he was the best man to lead a tiny army surrounded by enemies. As the quote implied, he was Godfrey's younger brother, and so had a slight advantage competing for Jerusalem with the other factions fighting for it. The most threatening of them being a bishop from Rome, who wanted the city to be, quote, ruled by God, i.e. by the Pope of Rome and his representative, the same bishop. Baldwin not only managed to push the bishop's suggestion out of the discussion, he, through some impressive victories, and really a crisis, won enough support to force the same bishop to anoint him as king, Baldwin I of the Kingdom of Jerusalem. And he got to his job, almost right away. First, like I said earlier, for Jerusalem to survive, it needed ports on the Mediterranean. So, barely 3 months into his reign, Baldwin made plans to get some of these ports, using a Genoese fleet that happened to land in the Holy Lands around his coronation, looking for trade opportunities. He made a deal with these sailors. In return for their aid in sieging ports, they will get a 1/3 share of any booty taken, as well as open no-tax trade into special zones in the Holy Land. The sailors, with little downside of the whole operation, agreed, and the first campaign of Baldwin's reign began. The first port was a small city named Arsuf, who, its citizens, when they saw the fleet on the sea and a small army and land, decided to surrender it within 3 days. Baldwin, rather than work something out with the Muslim population that just surrendered to him, he decided to kick them out of the Holy Lands, granting them safe passage as far as Ashkelon, as well as the right to take whatever they can carry with them. Moving from there, he went toward a bigger port, Caesarea. By this point, word have gotten out that Al-Afdal was on his way, in the first of his yearly campaigns against Jerusalem. And so, the governor of Caesarea decided to hold out. Unfortunately for the inhabitants, the crusaders had several advanced siege weapons and made quick work of the city walls. What followed then was another systematic massacre, where the city was stripped of everything valuable, the men butchered, and every single woman or child was enslaved and sold to the Genoese sailors. As an eyewitness put it, quote, "How much property of various kinds was found there? It's impossible to say. But many of our men, who had been poor, became rich." If you're curious, the exact number comes to about 48 gold coins to each man, plus 2 pounds of spices. With a total of about 8,000 men between the crusaders and the Genoese. So yeah, after Caesarea, the soldiers were happy. For his part, Al-Afdal, again, was just 2 weeks behind, with his army arriving in Ashkelon in late May 1101, led not by Al-Afdal, who is managing the transition to the 5-year-old caliph, and to be honest, probably was a little shell-shocked from his last round, but by one of his underlings named Sa'd al-Dawla. Now, rather than push into the crusaders' territory quickly and try to besiege them in Caesarea, Sa'd just hanged around in Ashkelon. And not only he hanged out and did nothing, he did it despite having anywhere between 5-1 or 20-1 numerical advantage, depending on what source you read. And it's really hard to figure out why. Maybe he was waiting for the Afdal to come. Or maybe he hoped that the Seljuks, relatively close by at Damascus, would make a move. Whatever the case, Sa'd just did not move, waiting all the way until September, the end of the fighting season, to finally make a move. Giving Baldwin and his knights plenty of time to regroup and plan for the eventual advance, picking their spot to fight, a small city named Ramallah, where the terrain was perfect for charging knights. What followed was an impressive victory, that saw Sa'd al-Dawla killed by Baldwin himself, if we are to believe the account of his personal priest, who, to be fair, was an eyewitness to the battle. Despite the victory, so, the overwhelming numbers of the Fatimid army meant that a whole unit of them, 500 in total, ended up being separated and thinking that they have won, since they ended up at the gates of Jaffa, a crusader city, with no resistance. And so did the citizens of Jaffa, seeing only Fatimid soldiers at their gate, and no signs of the king. The next day, like a badly written comedy, as Baldwin was going back to Jaffa with his victorious army, the Fatimid unit thought it was their own army that was coming, and ran toward them, only to realize in the last minute that it was not, and turn around and run in the opposite direction. Now, The reasons the Crusaders were able to cut through a 20,000-strong army with only 2,000 men, again and again, was simple. The Egyptian army had a fast, dwindling corps of experienced Armenian soldiers, but everyone else was raw recruits, either Nubian archers purchased at slave auctions, who were completely useless against heavy-armored European knights, or North African light horsemen, who were far less organized and experienced than the Crusaders. The heavy charge, the signature move of the Crusaders, consisted of a long row of heavily armored knights charging all together toward an enemy, as fast as horses can go. The natural response for those raw recruits was to run, which was also the worst thing that you can do. Even veteran soldier fighters had trouble facing a head-on heavy charge, eventually perfecting a technique of feigning a long retreat to make the Crusaders overextend themselves and then isolate smaller units outside the heavy charge. So yeah, Al-Afdal was the proverbial knife holder in a gunfight. And to be honest, he may have had quit right now and then, and made peace with the new arrivals, if it wasn't for what came next. A very rare close call. You see, almost right away, Al-Afdal mounted a second invasion of Palestine, again with a large army, this time led not by an underling, but by a promising young man, none other than Al-Afdal's oldest son, a certain sheriff. He, as one should, pushed his army as quickly as possible to surprise the Crusaders and catch them separated in various smaller garrisons before they can organize themselves as one big fighting unit. In a shocking speed, he managed to take Ramallah, the city of the last defeat, before Baldwin even realized that an army was invading his land. If Sharaf made it to Jaffa, where Baldwin was staying, it would be bad. Knights are great in an open field, but not so much enduring or breaking a siege. And so, Baldwin moved, erroneously thinking that there was no way a full Fatimid army would be moving that quickly. He reasoned that this is either a smaller army or just the vanguard, so his best shot was to attack them now, before they reach Jaffa. He only had 200 knights on hand, so basically his personal guard, plus a few guys who managed to escape the carnage of the Crusade of the Faint-Hearted, and just happened to be visiting Jerusalem at this inopportune time. These guys were super unlucky. Literally, they were already on a ship leaving when unfavorable wind forced them to go back. But anyway, Baldwin rode out, full of confidence that he can turn back the Fatimids, only to realize, when they came into the distance, that he was facing at least another 20,000 men. Yeah, you heard right. 200 knights versus 20,000 foot soldiers. And here is the crazy part. The 200 knights, rather than turn back and take their chances at the siege, they charged at the much larger army, with Baldwin himself at the head of the charge. It was like some unrealistic scene from a bad movie or something. As you would expect so, the numerical advantage was too much. Within minutes, Sharaf ordered an encirclement of the knights, and the bulk of them were hopelessly fighting for their lives. One small group figured out what was going on and got out quick before the encirclement, making it to Jaffa and shutting the door. The rest, well, they concentrated all of their efforts in protecting Baldwin and making him get out of the encirclement alive, an effort that barely succeeded as night fell, and Baldwin and few knights, probably less than 20, made it to an old tower nearby. Knowing that the tower would not withstand an assault when the day comes, Baldwin and 5 of his closest lieutenants disguised themselves and tried to sneak out through the Fatimid lines. To no one's surprise, they were caught, and a hand-to-hand fight in the middle of the night took place. Baldwin got on his horse and ran with one of his lieutenants, while the other 4 held down the Fatimids, continuing the melee while the king got away. What followed was a massive manhunt for the king, an entire army chasing one man who had neither food or water. It was so close that Baldwin ended up getting burned when the Fatimids burned the field that he was hiding in. The smoke gave him cover, so, and he managed to slip through again. Finally, 2 days later, he made it to Arsuf, the city that he kicked out its Muslim population earlier. Totally exhausted, he asked for food and water, and then, as if nothing else mattered, he slept. While he's sleeping, so, Sharaf moved his army and besieged Jaffa, the closest and the most important port to Jerusalem. If Jaffa fell, Jerusalem would follow. Further, Al-Sharaf had a small fleet of about 30 ships, and they managed to close off the city from the sea, making the situation desperate. To his credit, Sharaf also makes sure to pick up a corpse from the field, and mutilated enough that it resembled the king, and braided it in front of the knights who were left in Jaffa. It seems like this was it. And even the king wife, the queen, as well as some of the high-ranking knights, started making plans to get on a ship and try to escape through the naval blockade. And while they were discussing it, in this exact moment, a ship appeared from the north, bearing the standard of Baldwin. And not only it appeared, to the absolute shock of the Fatimid sailors, the ship seemed to be going toward them rather than away. In the confusion and the chaos that followed, the ship managed to slip through the blockade and make it into the harbor, again, despite some overwhelming odds. And Baldwin strolled into Jaffa to the absolute amazement of everyone, who have concluded that there was no way he had survived the last few days. You see, after sleeping for most of the day, Baldwin awake to quite the surprise. A pirate ship. Yeah, you heard right. All the way from England. Just happened to be in Arsuf in this exact moment. And what you know? The sailors, for whatever reason, they were open to the idea of Baldwin borrowing their ship. And so, like a messianic figure rising from the dead, Baldwin showed up in Jaffa in late May 1101. Now, as you can imagine, this was a huge psychological boost to the population of Jaffa. But underground, practically, the situation hasn't really changed. Jaffa was still besieged on land and by sea. The elite corps of the Crusaders were decimated on the battlefield a couple of days earlier. And the Genoese navy was long gone by this point, having made their profits in the previous year. Ultimately, what saved the Kingdom of Jerusalem was that Sharaf had lost his resolve. Something has broken him and sapped his confidence. Maybe it was Baldwin's many close call and his miraculous return. Or maybe when his army tried to force out the remnant of Baldwin's force from that old tower that he escaped from, only to see them rushing in a suicidal charge and fighting ferociously to the last man. Or maybe it was that Bilgamesh fleet that was on its way, that threatened to break the naval blockade of Jaffa and give Baldwin a few extra knights. Whatever the case, he moved away from the walls of Jaffa, retreating a sizable distance, with the flimsy excuse of needing to build siege weapons. But if you ask me, I really think that he was scared. He has seen too much to sleep peacefully with Baldwin and his knights within an earshot. And so, 2 weeks later, when Baldwin launched a half-hearted counterattack with whatever men he could gather, the Fatmids immediately packed their bags and went home. Given how the actual battles played out, you can't really call it a defeat. The Fatmids technically did not lose. But really, if you consider everything, they suffered a worse outcome. They were not defeated, they were broken. And so, the Kingdom of Jerusalem was born. Thank you for listening. Farewell, and until next time.